implications of Latin American experiences for U.S. healthcare reform?
That's correct. Basically, I'm going to be sharing a summary of I took a year sabbatical and I was able to get a fellowship to go to a Latin American country to study the healthcare system there. But before I get started, I have to say that I have no relationship to this clause in terms of the sponsorship of this conference. The objective of the presentation is to basically share some preliminary finding of some of the healthcare system in Latin American country with the intent to look at what kind of healthcare reform is happening, universal access, how system of healthcare are organized and financed. And there are other, you know, objectives that I have, but I'm just going to be basically mentioning some of those. The background and the interest came about because the Hispanic Latino population is growing very rapidly in the United States. And one segment of the population that is growing very rapidly is a group of Central and South America. But basically, in this slide, we says it's about 45 million Hispanic, representing close to 15%. Very little is known about the healthcare system of Central and South America. I teach courses at the University of Illinois College of Social Work on health policy, and most of the time I have to rely on what is written about Europe, Canada model, but very little about what's happening in other parts of the world. And so I had that also as an interest to be able to integrate that in future teaching. As you know, the U.S. System compared to Latin America, we spend over 16% of the gross national product on health care. Latin American countries between 4 and 8%. And we currently estimate the spending about $2.3 trillion or $7,600 per person. Very different from what we would see from Central and South America. And despite all that investment, still we have very serious challenges in terms of reducing infant mortality. Even the life expectancy in Costa Rica and Chile, as an example, are much higher than what we have here in the United States. And when I could go on and on, given some of those rationale. But like I said before, I received this scholarship, this fellowship from the Chicago Community Trust with a purpose to understand a little bit what's happening in Latin American country. I'm a Puerto Rican, so I have a personal interest. And so part of the countries that I visited included about 11 of them, and you have the map here of Latin American country. It includes Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Cuba, Mexico, Panama, Puerto Rico, Peru, Uruguay, and Venezuela. I ran out of time. I could have to come back to the United States to teach, so I couldn't, you know, complete other countries that I was interested in. I'm not going to be talking about all of them, but hopefully I will be highlighting a couple of those countries. The methodology was basically, once I got there, was visiting some of the local hospitals and clinics, talking to healthcare providers, talking to policymakers from the Minister of Health, and having group discussion with consumers and health professionals about what really was going on in the country, how can they best describe the healthcare system. Some of those interviews, most of them were audio tape and videotape. And currently, I'm just in the preliminary stages. I haven't completed all the analysis of the data. The main thing that I wanted to start with is that before the 1940, just to give a background about Latin American country, before 1940, there were practically no organized system of care. It was actually after 1940s that most of the Latin American countries started developing social security program, perhaps because in the United States in the 1930s, we had the Great Social Security Act that was passed, and there were aspects of that act that were integrated into some of the Latin American country. And so for workers, the social protection program allow the worker and the employer and the government to contribute for them to have retirement, health insurance, and some other benefit. And then you have, as part of, in many countries, as part of the Social Security, some welfare, where in Latin America, we talk about the concept of solidarity, where people contribute, everybody contribute who works, to a special fund managed by the government to be able then to provide services, and in this case, health care, to individuals that are not in the labor force. And so what you see is that prior to the 1970, most of the Latin American country already have developed a public healthcare system. And many of them, like Chile, have one of the most advanced national health system in place. But what happened? What we found is that they went through a series of financial problems. And so, and there were all the problems that had to do also with corruption and efficiency. But what happened is that there was a series of changes that really forces them to abandon this commitment to a public health care and national health care system. And this particularly became evident in the 1980s with the economic crisis, the International Monetary Fund, Fondo Monetario Internacional, recommended to this government to reduce, you know, to reduce government expenditure by cutting social and health programs. And then the World Bank Organization came on board and say, well, I'm willing to give you financial support if you are able to engage in healthcare reform that we call neoliberal system. And so what happened is that with that, the principles of the neoliberal reform was based on the free market system. They wanted this country to change the public health system that they already have in place and to adopt a system that is similar to what we call now managed care. So many of them were able to do that. Others resisted. And one of the countries that resisted, and there's more concept about, you know, the neoliberal, about really neglecting a number of areas, and I'm not going to go into detail about health promotion, occupational health. But one of the countries that really resisted this, and others actually resisted this movement of breaking down the public health care system, and the union actually played a very critical role to make sure that would not happen. But they included Argentina, Mexico, Colombia, and many others. But let me start, if I may, talk about Costa Rica. Costa Rica, you may know very little about this country in Central America, but they have the most effective national healthcare system, and they were the one who told the Banco, the World Bank, you know, forget about your money. We don't want it if that means that we have to destroy our system of care as we have right now. You have some general characteristics of that country in terms of their population and infant mortality, which again is much better than United States. But in 1941, Costa Rica established what they call La Caja Costarricense de Seguridad Social, meaning a social security program that again provided services, health care for the worker, pension, loans, and other social services. And they continue in the 1995 to expand the system of care to the point that now, currently, 90% of their population have universal health care access and utilization. Very, very effective program. They have a number of partnerships, but everything's under the Minister of Health. The way that they really have arranged their whole system of care is based on basic principle of universality, make sure that everybody has the same, you know, core package of benefit, equity, and solidarity, which is that everybody's responsible to take care of the healthcare system, particularly to those who cannot contribute to the public fund. And so not only they were able to do this, and it's the only country that I'm aware in Latin American country that they very effectively was able to do that, but they're able to integrate the healthcare system into an integrated system of care that is in a family, individuals, and community, and that is very holistic. It's very impressive when you visit the clinics and the hospital, how you have there the social worker, the psychology, how you have people with HIV receiving services with many other individuals receiving other kinds of care. So they have three levels of system in terms of organization, and actually this is characteristic of most of the other healthcare system that I was able to visit. You have the level, the first level, the level one, that provide a basic package or benefit to everybody, including home visit, health education, community health, because community partnerships is very critical in many of this country. Then the second level, that is more specialty care for those populations who need a little bit more specialty care, you have a hospital there. And then the third level for more complex kind of situation that people may experience. In the case of Costa Rica, they have what they call equipo básico de atención, basic attention with a team of multidisciplinary members that, again, include the physician, the assistant, the nurse, nutritionist. In our country, we're very fine in nutritionists in our healthcare system, psychology, community health worker, which we know that has been proven to be effective even here and in other countries. And then you have, you know, a whole backup system. So you have first the first level, which is the advice, as they call it, which is this smaller team that have a larger backup team that provides services as needed at the community level before they get into any hospital. hospital or any complex system for more serious problem. They really target certain groups, children and adolescents, women's health, adult and the elderly. And again, promotion is very much integrated into the different kinds of system of care, not only in Costa Rica, but in other countries that I visit. Brazil, if you're not aware, Brazil has moved into universal healthcare system since the 1990s. It's one of the few countries that have changed their constitution, saying that healthcare is a right. But the interesting thing about Brazil is that Brazil was able to, as a result of that, develop policies, not necessarily emerging from the health, from the public health sector, but you have policies in the area of education, with la escuela promotora. You have policy emerging in healthy housing, so housing industry. In many other non-traditional sectors, they have been able to develop a multi-level partnership, multi-sector partnership that are very instrumental in changing the way in which they address health and illness, and is very much aimed at wellness, with the recognition that you cannot have a healthy workforce if you're not really have a healthy one, you know, intervening in many different levels. So a strong recognition of social determinants. And again, you know, the employees and the employers and the government all working together and contributing for that system of care, community participation, very much part of this whole process. Cuba, we all know a lot about the Cuba system, very, very effective, despite the fact that with the political blockage, they have been, they haven't been able to have access to technology and things like that. But Cuba has a very effective single-payer universal healthcare system. Cuban national health system assumes full fiscal and administrative responsibility for the care of its citizen. They have doctors in every block. Every block that you walk, you see the doctor's office, living in the community, and then a couple of blocks away, you have a clinic that support that physician working alone in that clinic. And so people, access is very free. You go in and walk and talk to the, without any appointment. The relationship is very casual. The way that everything runs very smoothly. Argentina, another system. Argentina has, everybody has universal access, except that they have sectors that are privatized. And Argentina, and unfortunately, I'm going very fast because I know that the time is limited, but they have a public sector where 48% of the population have, you know, public health services coverage. And then you have the social security for workers, primarily. And then you have the private sector, which only 8% use the private sector. Can you imagine Argentina? Very few people really go to the private sector because they're so happy with how well the government manage the way in which the system is organized. And when you talk to them, they tell you about all this wonderful experience about patient and doctor relationship that is very, where you see the whole aspect they would call here cultural competency, really being integrated in the everyday aspect of working with a different provider. So excellent patient-doctor relationship. And the infrastructure in many of those countries is not as well as we would like because, you know, due to economic problems, they don't have the great technology that we have here. But at least whatever they have is accessible to everybody. Venezuela, we know a lot about Venezuela. Venezuela is interested. In the case of Venezuela, is going through a whole transformation where right now, from my perspective, the healthcare system is broken, it's fragmented. You have two public healthcare systems. One system that was before Chavez, and another system of public health that he have implemented since he came on board. And what he did, he has imported the Cuban model. But instead of working together with what he had in place, you have two parallel systems. So the Minister of Health comes from Cuba for that Cuban model that is called Barrio Adentro. All the workers, from the security guard to the nurses to everybody, are Cuban. And so you have two systems that are not talking to each other, that is confusing for the consumer, that seems to be very promising. The government is spending more money into the Cuban model and very little money to the other system, the other public system. So what you have there is the original public health care system with no money, no funding really falling into pieces, no technology. It was very depressing to go there. When you go to the other model that is funded through the government of Cuba and with the support of the current government in Venezuela, you have all the technology, beautiful facility, all the wonderful things, and all, you know, the great care is possible from my perspective there. So again, a lot of things happening in Venezuela that we need to look into, but there's a lot of tension between the healthcare professionals, and there are a lot of problems really in the way in which those systems of care are being developed. And my time is up, so I won't be able to talk to you about Colombia. The only thing that I could say is, in general, there are a couple of lessons to be learned. You find in the Latin American countries, and this screen is too big, so let me move this way. You find in Latin American countries, first of all, system of care that are more holistic, that is aimed at prevention and health promotion. You see that integrated community engagement participation is very much embedded in everything that is done in the system of care. You find that in many countries, some of those that I have mentioned have gone through healthcare reform and have been able to improve a system that is more effective in terms of universal access, in terms of a basic package of benefit. And it's surprising that they only spend between 4% of the gross national product, 4 to 8% in the case of Colombia, 8%. That it really tells us very clearly that, yes, it could be done, that with the money that we have in our current system, we could very well be able to learn a lot from what's happening with our other countries in this continent and be able to hopefully move into a system that will be able to access and use and provide the quality. Some of the presentation they said here about quality of care and discrimination, you don't find the consumer there. They may say, well, we don't have the greatest technology in terms of the electrocardiogram or whatever else it needs to be done, but everybody's happy in terms of minimal discrimination, or at least felt perceived discrimination. So I really want to thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Take care of some housekeeping. I want to thank you, all of you, for acknowledging, first of all, for showing up and preparing this. They're all good presentations. all but one of us observed the acknowledgement or disclosure, and I assume you.
Oh, yeah, I've noticed.
No, and I have no relation to any of these either, so I think that's all the housekeeping we need to take care of. Let's have some questions. Do you have some offhand? I've thought up a few, but I'd much rather have your questions of the presenters. And we could go in an organized fashion, or we could helter-skelter go through it. Does anyone have some questions we want to start with?
I have a question for one of the panelists about the HPV. Your study allowed you to find out how serious was the problem of HPV in this case in those areas that you work with the Mexican women and indigenous group?
No, because it was a qualitative study and it wasn't, the sample wasn't representative. In general, there's a high level of HPV prevalence in Mexican women, especially young women, as in other countries, and then it drops off. The main problem we have is with the oncogenic, the two types that cause cervical cancer in women and anal cancer in men, which are type 16 and 18, which are the vaccine would protect from. And the Mexican government is implementing the vaccine among disadvantaged girls starting next month.
Because your study has a number of policy implications. The fact that you said that they were getting results when they were possibly having cervical cancer, they were getting results that were not. I mean, all of that has a number of implications in terms of the way in which the services is being delivered and the lab work and everything. I don't know if you were able to have the opportunity or your will to really bring to bear those kinds of problems, you know, and the fact that the instrument that they were using were not, you know, safe, and that's why the women didn't want to use them, et cetera. I don't know if you were able to take that to one step further in terms of policy.
In terms of, I was talking about another.
Pardon me. Can everyone can hear that? Okay, good, fine.
Is that fine? The study I quoted about, the negative results that were really positive, is another study that just came out in cancer epidemiology, biomarkers, and prevention this month. But that's a completely different study that wasn't qualitative, obviously.
mentioned there's a high false negative rate. Is there, what's the false positive rate? Was that studied also? Was that of interest at all?
Yeah, that's also in the in the article that I mentioned. And the author is Lascano with a Z.
Uh-huh.
Lascano Ponce. And I'm a co-author in that, too. I don't remember the, but yes, that was a problem as well.
Uh-huh. Okay, and I just wonder if that influences the reactions or the experiences of the patients if they're either being missed and dying of cancer or if they're having unnecessary surgery. Is, do you have any
they wouldn't necessarily from there have unnecessary surgery.
I'm sorry,
but what would you have in, we would have there is an unnecessarily negative psychological impact in that they're being tentatively diagnosed with cervical cancer with some grade of precursor lesions, and then when they go to call colposcopy, they're being overtreated with colposcopy, which they didn't really need, and in there they would stop before surgery. We really haven't found any unnecessary surgery. But in a qualitative study that we did before, that my colleague Divina Sofia Palacio did, she did find, although it was qualitative, there were 50. It was with 50 women with cervical cancer being treated for cervical cancer. And many of the women talked about, well, I did get my pap test every year. And we didn't understand at that time what that was telling us. And we didn't understand whether they were saying they got their pap test, but they really didn't, or what was happening. And now we think that what was happening was they were getting their pap test, and they were getting a negative result, until finally it was detected somewhat too late, or you know, later than it should have been.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions on that study? Fascinating work you're doing. Some other questions? I think your study, yours had the statistics of relating the, I wondered how close that statistical method you used of taking into the indirect and the direct influences. Is that similar to path analysis that's worked out by the, forgetting his name now, statistician at the University of Pittsburgh years and years ago?
If I were to describe it, I'd say this is maybe the kid of path analysis, the more advanced child of path analysis.
Okay, so it's another step or two.
It is, yeah. So it's the same principle.
Okay,
yeah.
Let's see.
So follow up with that, what are the policy implications? I mean, what can be done from that information that you have been able to demonstrate that yes, that the ethnic and racial minority are experiencing discrimination, that is affecting their health status and use of services. What can we do about that?
Well, I think for me, I go to kind of the education route and training doctors to be more sensitive and more aware that their patients are experiencing, are feeling these, whether or not it's actually existing. The fact that these patients are perceiving it to be true, then they're kind of true in their consequences, so to speak. That's kind of where my mind goes in terms of policy implications.
I had a question.
Yeah,
I don't know if you looked at, there's an article about use of evidence-based information in Argentina by Belizan, Maria Belizan. I'm pretty sure it was published in 2007 in English. I can't remember the journal it was published in. It might have been Quality and Healthcare, I don't know. And she uses the stages of change model for doctors adopting evidence-based practice or guidelines and where they get their evidence. And then and it's a qualitative study. It would probably be interesting to you. It's BELICAN.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? I had a couple more I wanted to ask. This is a little picky thing about your study, Kathleen. Cardiology and oncology are subspecialties of internal medicine, so you separated those out that this was not an overlap.
No.
Okay. Good. And you raised really good questions about implementation delays, but I wondered, are there? Did you touch on the issue of quality of implementation, fullness of implementation of new?
That wasn't part of the study.
Yeah.
No, it's that, I mean, that certainly is the next stage, and I think a very valid
question.
Is
anyone measuring that?
Not that I'm aware of.
That was
the exciting part about this topic is, uh-huh. you know, I didn't find a lot of other people that were doing this sort of research, and yet, you know, and it was interesting because initially when I was setting up the study, I had contacted the New York State Health Department and asked them about partnering, you know, some of the questions that I wanted to ask, like how physicians were reimbursed with my insurance companies. They felt they were not questions that needed to be asked because they felt that wasn't an issue. And from having been in practice and talking with colleagues, I had a different perspective. So I think, you know, part of the study also shows where you sit, how you look at things. But the part that frustrated me was being in a policy program, so often decisions were made without the end user and their own. So that's sort of the motivating factor.
It impressed me years ago when I got into the business of CME that it's an assumption that if doctors take CME, they will then change, but there seems to be very little follow-up. I guess there are written exams or exams doctors sit for occasionally at periods, but those are not testing actual procedures and skillfulness and so forth. So it just seems as if that's a huge area that ripe for investigation and maybe some policy changes too.
Well, I think there's a lot of work being done right now with CMS in this area.
Good. Tell us about it.
The Center for Medicare Services, for instance, and there are several demonstration projects across the country where that is the goal, to see if physicians are appropriately uptaking evidence and evidence-based. And so there are a lot of new measures that are being developed. It's actually an area that is ripe for research and development because CMS is developing the quality standard that will eventually be used for P4P. You mentioned in your talk a little bit about paid for performance. And the other thing, too, is as far as recertification, the American Board of Internal Medicine now requires us all to take PIMS, right, the practice improvement modules when you're recert, which is exactly what you just said. You have to demonstrate that you have evaluated your practice and done some quality improvement. So definitely the field of education is shifting that way in a big, you know, way off before working on this.
Does PIMS test skills?
Does
PIMS test skills? Or is it just knowledge?
What do you mean by skills? It's neither skills nor knowledge. The PIMS, they're different PIMS, but the QI practice improvement module will ask you, for instance, to identify your panel of diabetic patients, let's say. And if you're able to see a gap there, for instance, they're not getting referrals in ophthalmology or something, you have devised a strategy to respond to that. So you can say, as my PIM, I now have an automatic referral system, or now I have ophthalmologists on site, or something like that. So it's neither skill nor knowledge. It's really action and QI based.
Outcomes is what
they're doing. Right. It's all outcomes. Sorry.
Okay. I'm sorry.
As a follow-up to that, I was at the Institute of Medicine meeting on quality improvement and less quality improvement research in D.C. about 10 days ago, and the president of the American College of Graduate Medical Education was there and talking about how they're going to go from a knowledge-based testing for medical residents to more competency-based.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's another thing altogether with the steps.
I have a very general question about Latin American. We look at other countries, and we have all this wealth here, and we think we're so good at practicing, and we find surprising to us that so many countries have surpassed us in longevity and other measures of healthcare. Do you come up with any general lesson of what we could apply here? It seems, for instance, let me give you, I visited New Zealand years and years ago. I found out that they had made a national decision to make some changes, and there are several. One was to get out of the business of, tobacco, I think, and to sell tea instead. And so this was a national decision that was made, and what can we do here to, do we need smarter people or wiser people or?
Well, it's just a different set of values. Here our empathy has been to be able to continue in improving the technology and better medication, but not to put the same amount of effort in making sure that everybody have access to this new technology or medication or whatever. So it's two different approaches. In Latin American country, what we can learn, and I try to allude to that, number one, there's a lot that needs to be learned in terms of integrating health promotion and disease prevention at the primary care level. Our healthcare system is very curative oriented, and very little has been done. And with managed care, as you know, it's more curative. You don't have multidisciplinary team, you don't have the commitment to be able to begin to integrate health promotion and disease prevention kind of strategies, which involve looking at the environment if we're going to be targeting the social determinants of health. So that's one lesson. The holistic approach, the health and mental health that is integrated, that in every clinic that you go, you see the psychology, the social worker, the dealing with issues of violence, dealing with many other issues that are not necessarily, you know, issues of illness, but it also alludes to the environment and alludes to other problems, and that addresses the depression and many other mental health related issues that people have. So that's another thing that there's many different advocacy organizations trying to move in that direction, but we haven't been doing a good job in integrating health and mental health and having a more holistic view of health. The other aspect from the policy perspective is those countries that I was able to study really have in their constitution a clear, you know, mandate that health care is a right and not a privilege. I mean, they really, it's their constitution. The case of Venezuela is worded differently. The case of Venezuela is something that everybody has the right to medical care, which is slightly different from Brazil that says that health care is a right, you know. So the problem with Venezuela is that when the health care is not accessible because the mandate is for universal access, if people, whatever way the system cannot accommodate, they have to then figure out a way, and actually Colombia has similar issues, they have to then write a letter to El Soberano, they call it. The Soberano is the president of the nation, asking that I haven't been able to get this kind of procedural surgery or whatever, and then they have to, the government may issue a check or whatever, million pesos or whatever they have to provide, to make sure, because the Constitution said that the government has to figure out a way of making sure that these services is accessible. In Colombia, they have similar kinds of mandate in the Constitution, so what they do, they have a jury system that every time you're not happy with what you're getting, because the government is mandated to make sure that you get the services, then you have to go to a court system and hearings and everything else. And the limitation there is that you have to talk to people who have no understanding of health and medicine that makes legal decision about whether or not you're entitled to that transplant or whatever else that they may not get to. So, but one of the things that's happening right now is that Congressman Koges in Michigan, he's trying for the local, he's trying to change our constitution to have that clause of health care as a right. And we haven't been able to do that. And so that's something that as the movement keeps improving and you have more support for single payer, that is something that perhaps may happen someday. We may not see it.
Good. Yes.
Thank you all for the presentation, by the way. They were really very enjoyable. I had a quick sort of practical take home question to ask about the C. diff work that you've done. Because looking at the variables you found that were associated with C. diff, I mean, this is a problem we have. Really big problems. So looking at this, is your advice that medicine services, the use of PPI, what are you doing at your institution now as a result of that work?
One of the risks, like if you see pretty much all the risk factors were favorable or unfavorable in medicine patients, like everything, they were elderly, they were staying more in the hospital, and usually surgical patients tend to be younger or healthier. I mean, unless the patient is cleared for surgery, patient would not be admitted. So maybe there was an underlying problem which was not highlighted by this.
And then surgeons always transfer the patients to medicine anyway and post-op.
Well, actually, we kind of, no, that is true, but we kind of looked only at those patients who were admitted specifically on medicine and surgery. If there was any inter-service transfer, we did not look at those patients. So that was avoided. But I guess general, patients who were cleared for surgery would only go for surgery, so maybe that was advice that was kind of not highlighted in this.
But should I stop giving people? Do you think the work is too preliminary to make policy?
No, there are actually recommended cases. There are documented cases, or there are literature, research shows that PPI insurance should be avoided. Like, many times people would go with upper respiratory tract infection and they would get antibiotics, although the doctor knows that it is probably viral and antibiotics have no relief. But if then they do get prescribed, and I guess overuse of antibiotics and overuse of PPIs would certainly, if we can curb that, I think we can make some improvement. And most important thing is, like, in hospital would be contact precautions, washing hands. That is the most important thing in prevention of this. Yeah, I mean, spores are actually, if you culture, you find it everywhere in the nose. Yeah, exactly. And alcohol gel is not effective against the spores, so you actually have to wash hands.
I had a little tinky question, too, about the spores. Are they airborne as well, or are they only picked up from surfaces?
Fecal transmission. So, usually the spores are excreted in the stool, and then fecal, and they can be just, you know, in the patient's environment.
So it's by touching?
Yeah, exactly. It's by touching. There is no airborne transmission.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.